Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Tom Woods Show. This is episode 2489, and I'm delighted to welcome, I think, back Ben O'Neill. Ben, I think an awful long time ago, I actually had you on The Tom Woods Show. Ben has had what we might think of as a rather hybrid career in and out of academia. He's a professional statistician and economist. He's taught at Australia National University, University of New South Wales. He does statistical and economic consulting as of right now. And he's done some very interesting work, in particular on the subject of anti-discrimination law and the whole culture of anti-discrimination. I'm going to link in the video description, as well as at tomwoods.com/2489, to his Google Scholar page, and you'll be able to find some links there. But Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It has been a long time.
Now, we've got, yes, I didn't even go back to look, but it is quite some time. Now, obviously, most people listening to this program are American, but I would say about, it's something like 17 to 20% are from other countries, and so maybe a handful even in Australia. But most of us know the history of anti-discrimination law in the United States, and that the big, big piece of legislation was the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I don't actually know what the history of anti-discrimination in Australia is. Did it occur at roughly the same time, and does it consist of roughly the same rules?
There's a little bit of a lag, but you're only talking about a lag of probably a decade. In Australia, anti-discrimination law was brought in a set of bills targeting different things. We have a Racial Discrimination Act, Sex Discrimination Act, various other acts have been brought in at different times, and these did lag the US a little bit. In Australia, there was also a constitutional referendum with respect to the constitutional status of Indigenous people in our country that occurred at around the same time as the civil rights era in the US. Things had happened probably roughly at the same time, but I'd say with a little bit of a lag, probably following US trends, it's fair to say.
Okay. Well, I was just curious about that. Now, this is, I mean, there's so many third rails of American politics. You know, there's Social Security and Medicare, and whether you should try to do something about that coming fiscal train wreck, or there's the relationship between the United States and Israel. Very hard to discuss that without everybody going berserk. But anti-discrimination law may trump all of them, because this is the sort of thing everybody knows is, like, all right-thinking people know is a good thing. Some of them may be opposed to affirmative action, but they favor anti-discrimination law. So,
yeah, and I guess this is where a loudmouth lunatic like me who'll say anything comes in.
Right. This is what I'm very happy to invite you on, because for one thing, I don't think you really can, conceptually, you really can separate anti-discrimination law from affirmative action, because how are we going to know if you're not discriminating, given that we can't read your mind? The only thing we can do is look at the demographic makeup of your workforce. So therefore, you have to engage in affirmative action.
Well, this gets into quite interesting territory. My interest in this, actually, I'm probably a little bit unique in that my main interest in this is not really from a moral or political standpoint, although that is interesting. My main interest in this topic is as a statistician and someone who's an expert at essentially statistical inference, and which is essentially the science of how we make decisions inferring the unknown from the known. And this bears very heavily on discrimination problems. I sometimes say that statistical science is the science of discrimination. So actually my interest in this topic is more around the kind of statistical dynamics. But the issue you raise is a very interesting one. I think the prevailing theory of discrimination that's so ubiquitous in our society, what I've called in my writing the anti-discrimination paradigm, or what's sometimes called the progressive theory of discrimination, is this view that in the absence of adverse, unfair, unscientific discrimination against people, that you would get essentially proportionate equality of outcome in social processes. And then when people don't see that as the outcome that occurs, the next step is to say that, well, there must be some additional discrimination going on that we can't detect if the outcomes are unequal in a proportionate sense. And therefore, the entire essentially apparatus of anti-discrimination law becomes this apparatus of detecting inequality of outcome through statistical methods. And then if that is detected within appropriate statistical tolerances, saying that discrimination must have occurred and possibly imposing some kind of positive discrimination or affirmative action as a alleged corrective to that.
Right. Now, I noted that you some years ago reviewed a book by Thomas Sowell on discrimination and disparities. And his work on this is tremendous and is very complementary to your own, because your own, in some cases, might be viewed as, not that there's anything wrong with this, but theoretical. And he has got all these empirical examples of statistical disparities that we can obviously tell have no sinister origin. I mean, the fact, for example, that I believe men are something like 8 times as likely as women to be struck by lightning. Now, that doesn't mean that lightning is seeking men out. You know, we instantly know that that would be preposterous. But yet, given that the reigning assumption, as you say, is that if disparities exist, the initial automatic conclusion is that it has some sinister motive, it's caused by quote-unquote racism, and the benefit of somebody like Sowell is to come along and show in the real world where a lot of times if you correct, even if you simply correct for differences between populations, if you correct for education and age and whatever, you find that the alleged disparities actually disappear.
Yeah, well, the wonderful thing about the example you just gave, which Sowell uses in his works, is obviously lightning being a natural phenomenon is not making any conscious decisions at all. So if this is an instance where outcomes differ systematically across demographic groups, which they do, and the empirical evidence shows that, and discrimination is literally impossible when you're talking about a natural phenomenon that doesn't reason, then it does act as a very strong falsifying mechanism to that theory. But I think where that confusion comes from, I think generally speaking, people who aren't trained in statistics, I suppose, have often a fairly poor understanding of the relationship between correlation and cause. Correlation meaning simply the empirical tendency of things to go together or not go together, and cause obviously being cause, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. One of the things we learn in scientific education is this very commonly referred to principle that correlation does not imply cause. Many of your listeners have probably heard this saying that correlation doesn't imply cause. It's something we drum into science students at the universities. And what we're trying to tell them is that the mere fact that two things go together doesn't necessarily mean that one is the cause of the other. And this is something that, you know, really any scientifically literate person learns. What is less appreciated, which is an equivalently true principle, is the contrapositive of that, which is that the absence of cause does not imply the absence of correlation. So if there is an absence of, say, discrimination causing differences in outcome, that does not imply that there would be no differences in outcome. And I think it's a failure to appreciate the kind of contrapositive of that scientific principle that leads people to this intuitive but wrong view that in the absence of demographic discrimination, we would expect to get social process outcomes that are proportionate essentially to people's numbers in the host population.
Yeah, in effect, I would be willing to guess that that's probably never occurred anywhere for any measure because of all the differences that exist. In fact, Sowell has an older book called Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality that's, I suppose, probably an earlier version in a way of the Discrimination and Disparities book that I think brings the argument up to date. But in there, he is very much at pains to demonstrate this point that it was something like Polish Americans are 25 years older on average than Puerto Ricans. Well, that alone means you will never, ever get the same numbers out of them because you've had 25 extra years to build up your net worth. You have more education. There are all kinds of reasons you could be doing better, you know, in terms of financial success and what have you. But you go down the line and it's not just statistics like that. It's things like, at least at the time of publication, Mexican-American women, half of them were married by age 18, but only 10% of Japanese-American women were married by age 18. Do you think that might affect, first of all, it'll affect almost certainly the age at which they have children? Do you think that might affect how much they're in the workforce, how much they earn? These things are everywhere. And so to think that you're just going to get, well, we have 10% X in the population, so there'll be 10% X in every occupation, is, to say the least, not reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the kinds of empirical examples Sowell gives that you've just mentioned are really good illustrations of that. I sometimes tell my students when I'm teaching them, and this is only a slight exaggeration, but only slightly, I tell them everything is correlated with everything. Meaning effectively, that, as you say, you know, race is correlated with age of marriage, which is correlated with wealth, which is correlated with health, which is correlated with everything. You know, certainly the absence of correlation in these social process outcomes is the exception rather than the rule. It will tend to occur either very, very rarely by coincidence, or when someone actually intervenes with affirmative action to force equality of outcome. That's about the only time you see it. So I think you're certainly right that that is the exception rather than the rule.
Folks, in this day and age, there are a lot of competing demands for your time, and a lot of them are a complete waste of your time. Well, I have an excellent way to deal with it all. With the Blinkist app, you can absorb huge amounts of information in 27 nonfiction categories like history, philosophy, parenting, career, technology, and religion. And Blinkist takes each of these books and condenses it into a 15-minute summary you can read or listen to. So that means if you have a half-hour commute each way, you can be absorbing the equivalent of 4 books. You think that might make you a more impressive person? And one way you know the folks at Blinkist are pretty good people is that, unlike virtually any other service, among the thousands and thousands of titles you'll find at Blinkist, you'll also find libertarian classics by Murray Rothbard, Milton Friedman, and dare I say, even your own host here. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 40% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 40% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. And now, for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. All right, now let's get into the stuff that Ben O'Neill says fearlessly in his published work. To my great surprise, by the way, in the Independent Review, I'm impressed and somewhat shocked that some of this got in there. So you have an article called The Anti-Discrimination Paradigm, Irrational, Unjust, and Tyrannical. And relatively early on, you talk about statistical inference and quote-unquote discrimination. So I hereby, and perhaps I'm sure that taxi driver example is still valid today. So I invite you to share what your argument is there.
Sure. So this goes back to some economic research that started in about the 60s and 70s on a phenomenon called statistical discrimination, sometimes called rational discrimination. Essentially how this works is, suppose that we encounter a person that we don't know very much about in some context, and there's various characteristics of theirs that would be of relevance to some decision we have to make to them. The example I give in the paper, or one of them, is an example from the 1980s where a group of scholars did a empirical analysis of the behavior of taxi drivers in Los Angeles in the 1980s, and they found that taxi drivers were less likely to pick up young black males as fares, and they investigated into this. In that kind of situation, you have a problem with very limited information. The taxi driver has to make a decision about whether or not to pick up a person based on a very small amount of information, just observing them very briefly, in which they can really only pass that person's race, sex, approximate age, you know, basic clothing and demeanor in a very short observation window. And they have to make a decision of whether this is a fare that is going to be a safe one to pick up, or whether they're at risk of some kind of crime. And one of the things that statistical discrimination teaches us is that when there are what we might call merit characteristics here, say whether the person's going to beat you up or not, that are unknown to you, statistical inference can be used to try to guess what those characteristics are from any other characteristic you can observe that is correlated with that. So if demographic characteristics like race, sex, age, etc. are correlated with, say, crime, which we know empirically they are in 1980s Los Angeles, for example, then statistical inference tells us it is rational to discriminate on the basis of those characteristics as effectively proxies to try to guess the unknown characteristic of true interest. And what's crucial there to understand is that that is rational irrespective of whether those demographic characteristics have any causal impact on the thing of interest. So we need not believe that biology and race causes crime. We need not believe that, for example, a person is racially predisposed to crime or something like that. We need not have any causal belief there. It's sufficient that those are correlated for any empirical reason, in which case it's valid to use one as a predictor of the other in that kind of circumstance.
Now, when you say valid, do you mean morally valid, like the taxi driver?
Well, I'm talking here from the kind of validity of a kind of a statistical procedure as a logically valid inference procedure. I do go on in the paper, though, to argue that having established that that is the optimal logical way to behave and that this is a rational inference procedure, that it is also morally valid. It's appropriate to view that as a morally valid action. It will be an action that tends to, on the taxi driver's end, minimize their risk and reduce their victimization against crime. It also creates some useful incentives at a collective level for groups to reinforce good values within their own community, effectively to try to prevent people who look like them from doing bad stuff so that it doesn't impact them negatively in a statistical discrimination sense. And it has certain, you know, other aspects that give it a good moral foundation. But more generally, I think a lot of, you know, the kind of theories of morality that I've found the most compelling are those that are built on the idea that we ought to act rationally in situations, that we ought to incorporate all available information, that we ought to try to make judgments of other people, that, you know, sensible, measured, rational judgments based on the information we have. And so in that sense, I do argue that this is a morally valid thing to do in addition to a valid method of statistical inference.
All right. Well, let's think about what some people might say in response to that, which I could imagine people saying, well, it's hard to imagine people saying this, but let's say they were willing to meet you 80% of the way and saying, obviously, there is a connection.
They're usually willing to meet me, Tom. So this is very generous.
Well, I'm starting off with the easy ones. Okay. So let's say they're willing to concede. All right. Well, there obviously is some connection between these things. And we understand that you're not claiming that it's a necessary connection, but that all the same, there is a connection. But what does this mean for the average person who belongs to the race in question, who through no fault of his own is now being, in effect, kind of targeted for at least some kinds of mistreatment that he did nothing to deserve? And so on the individual level, this does seem like an injustice.
I certainly think it's something for which a person should have our sympathies, whether or not it's an injustice. I certainly think you're correct that in this instance, you will get people who, through unchosen characteristics, say, can't get a taxi or are at least less likely to get a taxi. I don't think you've necessarily looked at both sides of the ledger with that objection. One of the things that this study found was that black taxi drivers were just as likely to discriminate against young black males as white taxi drivers. So evidently, black male taxi drivers also felt safer engaging in this statistical discrimination process. And I think it's reasonable to expect that, given that that inference method generally ought to be expected to work to some degree, that less taxi drivers probably got assaulted and robbed based on their rational statistical discrimination. And that would include less black male taxi drivers, for example, also being victimized. So there are two sides of the ledger here, but I certainly do sympathize with a young black male, for example, in 1980s Los Angeles, tries to flag a taxi and is turned down. You know, it's certainly not an ideal outcome. One of the things I think that we can take some solace in is the fact that if we have this kind of negative incentive, it does create some internal incentive within a community to say, okay, why is this happening to us? And ultimately, this is happening because of the bad guys who beat up taxi drivers, right? They're ultimately the data, if you like, that leads to the adverse discrimination, right? So any young black male who has beaten up a taxi driver is the data on which those taxi drivers are now avoiding that demographic group. So I think it does create then an incentive within that community to try to use their existing culture to reinforce some social pressure, perhaps, on others to, you know, behave better. One would hope that, at least.
And one would hope that, but in what happens in reality under a state is that generally the state and its various hangers-on instead spread the idea that there's absolutely no reason for those taxi drivers to make those decisions. And once again, you are purely a victim for no reason. And so then no valuable progress gets made. No one talks about what needs to be talked about.
Yeah, and I think that's true. But I mean, I guess that just then goes back to the value of trying to teach people about the nature of rational statistical discrimination. I think if the population at large understood this better, then I think there would be a greater understanding of where the roots of these problems actually lie. I think discrimination itself often gets the blame for other forms of pathology that are the root cause of those kinds of situations which you're describing, which are, you know, situations that harm people and for which they should have our sympathies. But I don't think we necessarily focus on the correct thing to try to fix in those circumstances.
I'm curious, by the way, if there was ever a study done about the likelihood, especially, let's say, late at night, that a taxi driver would pick up a man versus a woman of any race.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that particular study was that general, but I mean, in general, you know, men are a much more high-risk group for crime
than
women.
Yeah, so I wonder if what kind of result you'd get.
You know, that's something that obviously, you know, everyone is aware. I mean, all other things being equal, men are more higher risk than women, and males in, you know, young adulthood are probably in the highest risk category for, you know, criminal violence. So there is good empirical data, and I think people understand this, that the high-risk categories are men, young men, and certain racial groups, depending on what particular country you're in. People have, I think, a good sense, at least roughly, of where these high-risk groups are. Actually, it's interesting you mentioned men, sorry. Just apropos that topic, there was a little bit of a controversy went around, I think it would have been about a decade ago now. I remember this, there was a guy who came around a bunch of US campuses giving a talk, I think it was called She Fears You. And this caused a bit of a stir. This guy went around a bunch of campuses on the US and essentially counseled young men of the fact that when they're walking alone at night and they walk past women or they walk within the vicinity of women at night, they should be aware of the fact that women may fear them even though they're personally good guys, right? And this caused a little bit of a stir. Some young men were very upset with the idea that even though they're personally a nice guy, that they would be feared and treated as a potential predator. Myself, at the time, was, you know, a younger man and liked to walk at night, and I had this very experience. You have to, you know, be a bit careful when you're walking at night. If there's females around, you need to be aware that you are perceived as a potential threat to them. I think it's because I understood rational discrimination that I was never offended by that. I just understood that this is not a negative commentary on me personally. This is simply a consequence of that person having very limited information about me, knowing very little about me, and simply knowing that I am in a high-risk group and acting accordingly.
Well, I'll be honest. When I was a little bit younger, and if I would, you know, I didn't have facial hair, but if I would go without shaving for a while and I would show up at the airport, I would look suspicious. I looked like I was up to something. And I wouldn't say I got a lot of suspicious looks, but I wouldn't say I got zero. But again, I didn't think to myself, what a terrible injustice. I thought, well, I'm sorry that people like me keep causing problems. You know, I wish they'd stop. Then I wouldn't have this issue.
Yeah, I've had the same experience, actually. Every time I go through an airport, I seem to be the guy that gets pulled up for a quote-unquote random bomb chemical analysis and, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, look, I'm probably, you know, have been traveling at times where I am, you know, military age male and, you know, in that group. But look, it doesn't bother me simply because, again, I think having an awareness of statistical discrimination also gives you an awareness of the fact that, you know, you may, through no fault of your own, be in a high-risk group, which is a higher-yield group for people searching or targeting for potential negative things. And it's not a commentary on you personally. It's simply a product of limited information.
Now, you in this particular article, as I said, I'm linking to Google Scholar, but I should probably link to this piece of you, this particular piece from the Independent Review.
Probably a good one.
Yeah, I would say it is. It's very systematic. And as it comes to a conclusion, you have the subheading, The Injustice of the Anti-Discrimination Paradigm. So I think a lot of libertarians would say that what's unjust about it is the coercion involved. But that's not the angle you're taking here, although I'm no doubt you object to the coercion involved. But even if there weren't coercion involved, the idea that I'm supposed to have certain mental states and it's wrong of me to have other mental states is also part of the anti-discrimination paradigm. So what, in fact, in your view, is unjust about it?
Yeah, I think it's deeper than just the coercion, although, as you say, that is an aspect of the injustice. You know, I think at a deeper level, the anti-discrimination paradigm that forms the kind of philosophical basis for, I suppose, anti-discrimination law and more lately what we call wokeness, it's built on a set of axioms that are false. One of those axioms is that all discrimination is wrong, and that is false simply because we do have this category of statistical discrimination that is actually quite a rational thing to do. Another axiom of that paradigm is that in the absence of discrimination, whether rational or irrational, that outcomes would be proportionate across groups, subject only to random statistical variation. That's also false, as we've discussed. And then finally, the third kind of thing that you see in this paradigm is that because they observe outcomes which are not obeying that expectation, there's this belief that you need to engage in affirmative discrimination to equalize outcomes, and that doing so is benign, that it doesn't lead to adverse consequences generally or lower merit characteristics for the targeted groups. So all of this kind of manifests in a kind of feedback loop where, I mean, say I'm a believer in the anti-discrimination paradigm, right? What's going to happen is I'll say, okay, no one discriminates. And we try and stamp out discrimination. And let's say we do so largely successfully, like we make it verboten for people to express racist views in society. We make it, you know, a very strong culture of don't discriminate, don't discriminate, don't discriminate. But yet we see there's still massive inequality of outcome in all sorts of social processes. So then what you see happen is, okay, well, we have to double down. We have to double down. We need to enforce this culturally harder and harder and harder and harder. And the answer is, if we're still getting inequality of outcome, there must be some hidden racism, sexism, etc. there. And so you get this transition occurring from an initial advocacy that, okay, we need to get rid of, you know, overt sexism and racism. Then it's, oh, well, there's implicit sexism and racism. We need to get rid of that. And then you get all the way to, well, we can't see anything, so it must be structural. Like, in other words, completely unobservable structural racism, meaning effectively that all we can see is disparities in outcomes, and that's enough for us to say that this is still happening. And you get this kind of psychosis forming, I suppose you could say, where you're getting more and more frustrated that the outcomes aren't equal. You know, your theory says that if you get rid of the discrimination, the outcomes should equalize, and you're pushing hard and you're, you know, beating people to death with this culture, and it still doesn't happen. Well, at a certain point, I think this is where you see these kinds of pathologies arising, these kinds of overt hatreds for groups that are getting better outcomes in the social processes, this kind of overt disparagement of groups that are getting better outcomes in those social processes, direct intervention in terms of affirmative action and discrimination against those groups, differential standards of behavior and so on expected of different groups. And you start to see this kind of thing arise, and it leads to all sorts of these pathologies, including, you know, the re-arising of racist ideas and things like this. So I think there's a lot of injustice there in a cultural sense, far beyond just the coercion. And I think this essentially comes as a kind of reductio ad absurdum of a set of false principles that are widely adopted.
Hey folks, if you're a homeschooling parent, you're probably working too hard. The self-taught K-12 Ron Paul curriculum, to which I contributed hundreds of lessons on history and government, is the answer. For one thing, your students will actually learn, get this, that there are two sides to the argument at a time when their peers don't even realize there is an argument. But in addition to the standard subjects, we also teach what the state's ideological prison camps should teach, but don't, like how to run a home business, how to manage money, how to be an effective public speaker. And that's just for starters. Not to mention, if you sign up through my link, you get $160 worth of free bonuses that you won't get otherwise. So head over to my link, which is ronpaulhomeschool.com. We see this kind of thinking in other paradigms, like, for example, Keynesianism. If there's an attempt at fiscal stimulus of an economy and it doesn't seem to do anything and things get worse, the presumption is never, well, maybe our whole approach to this is wrong. Maybe our whole the way we're conceptualizing the problem is wrong. It's, we didn't do enough. And then they keep doing it and it's never enough. Or during the COVID stuff, well, everybody's wearing a mask. Maybe that wasn't enough. So not enough people are wearing masks. It must be that there are some people we can't see anywhere, but somewhere they're not wearing them and we got to get tougher on them. So it never occurs to them to say, maybe this is not actually a useful mechanism to get our desired outcome. It's, we just haven't pushed it hard enough. And that, I think, is what's so sinister about the calls for, quote, equality, which could mean anything, and in fact has meant anything. And the general anything that it means is that the political regime can intervene in all kinds of aspects of life in order to bring about this elusive outcome. They never reach it. And they never reach it because there are a million possible reasons for them not to reach it. When I think about, for example, the reason that there's a white-black achievement gap in schools, like close to a four-grade achievement gap, this is not because the schools are just discriminating against black students and they're just, in a very hostile way, preventing them from getting the resources they need. That is absolutely not true. I mean, you look at virtually all school districts in America are run by progressives. They're run by the very people who, if anything was going to work, have tried that thing. They've basically tried every possible thing. And so the answer now is not that, well, whatever the explanation for this, it's beyond the ability of the schools to fix. Maybe it's in the household. Who knows what the explanation is? But the schools have done pretty much everything they can at this point. No, now it's that the discrimination is so deep and profound and intense, we can't even perceive it. So now we have to somehow pull it out of our society bit by bit, even though we can't perceive it immediately. We'll have to like dig back and pull back layers and see what we can find. And it'll never occur to them, well, we've looked everywhere, I guess it's not there. Then it'll just be even deeper, requiring further intervention into your life, requiring further mad government activity. So I think that's the thing, is that they latch onto something. And when it, quote, doesn't work, it's always because they haven't applied enough of it.
Yeah. And I think this comes back to this being a kind of an axiomatic theory, which is treated as unfalsifiable. I mean, essentially, the anti-discrimination paradigm treats its axioms as unfalsifiable. So when the observation is that merits and outcomes are not equal across different demographic groups in social processes, instead of taking that ever as evidence that perhaps this assumption that they ought to be might not be correct, as you say, the conclusion rather is always that discrimination and hostility against the low outcome groups is still present and hidden more than we thought it was, and more subtle and more perverse than we thought it was. And perhaps it's buried deep in the structure. You see, a lot of the advocates of this kind of view have literally moved towards the point where they will say that, for example, racism without racists is a phrase they'll use, that this could be a thing where without any individual ever having any kind of malicious thought or action, that simply the structure of society and institutions itself in a kind of an abstract way is sufficient. And so I think, yeah, you're talking about that lack of falsifiability. One thing I would say with what you just brought up, I'm not sure I agree entirely with it, because I actually think the progressive educators that you're talking about have made things much worse. One of the perverse aspects of this kind of thinking is that, for example, when you're talking about the students, you know, when you get inequality of outcomes across race groups within schools, one of the things that these progressive educators have said is they've said, okay, the problem here is structural racism. And so in order to try to solve that, we're going to take present behavioral aspects of the groups that are lagging behind and treat their behavior as if it's not problematic at all, and make sure they're, you know, we won't hold them, for example, to standards of punctuality and so on. So you see these doctrines arising. You may have seen this, that, for example, punctuality is a form of whiteness and rigor is a form of whiteness and all of these kinds of things that we would have think of as simply the methods by which you educate someone correctly and improve their circumstances, that those constitute harmful whiteness and their antipode is authentic blackness. And therefore, you won't teach a young black student how to think with rigor or how to be punctual or how to develop any of these aspects of executive functioning that would actually improve their education. So I actually think you end up perversely making these things worse. And, you know, sometimes the result is that you take these groups who are already lagging behind and you just completely screw them over by giving them counterfeit education. Going back to Sowell actually in his autobiography talks about his own schooling at an exceptional school that produced, I think, not only Sowell, but I think a black chief justice and another one who became an admiral. And he talks about the kind of schooling that he was given. And it was essentially that kind of traditional schooling where he was held to a high standard. You know, there was certainly no aspect of any teacher saying, oh, well, you're black, so you don't have to comply with punctuality and you don't have to comply with rigor because those are whiteness. So I think, you know, what you're talking about is, I think these progressive educators are really sabotaging people.
I think that's a more recent phenomenon. I think that came along after their first attempts didn't work. So
that's probably fair, yes.
Yeah, so I think it conforms to what I said in the sense that as time goes on, when the various efforts don't work, they have to come up with ever more wildly implausible explanations for why they're not working. And as you say, one of them is, well, we can't hold them to these extraneous standards. But I mean, my gosh, and it's not like only black students are having this done to them, but they are the outstanding example because they have uniquely bad leadership. If I were a black leader, I would be saying, okay, we're going to chuck all of this because all of it's an insult. Like what? I can't show up on time because I'm black. I mean, will you knock that off? I mean, if you don't expect certain results from people, then you're probably not going to get them. But if you do expect them, you have a better chance of getting them. But really, at this point, white supremacy has been defined to include almost any just ordinary way somebody might act. And so now we're almost like at the end game of this, because beyond that, where else can they go? They've already demonized every good quality. Where else can they go if this doesn't work?
And I mean, this is why I say I consider a lot of this stuff to be essentially just the reductio ad absurdum of a set of false assumptions. They are going to play out to their absurd, ridiculous conclusion until eventually it must either degenerate back into classical racism or implode completely. It's interesting you mentioned that, you know, this is not just black students we're talking about and black people in general. There's a great author, Theodore Dalrymple, is his pen name, but Anthony Daniels is his actual name. He has written a number of books about the white underclass in Britain. And if you read these, it's the exact same pathologies. It is the exact same outcomes. So you find that this is not something that's kind of an inherently racial thing. It has one dynamic in the US. It has another dynamic in the UK. And completely different racial groups can suffer from these same adverse outcomes and things like this under very similar cultural circumstances. So one of the kind of points that Dalrymple makes is that there's a great deal of parallel between, I suppose, the white underclass in the UK compared to, say, the black underclass in the US and a lot of the same problems and a lot of the same outcomes.
Well, I'm going to, as I said, I'm going to link to this particular article and your Google Scholar link. I'll put that in the description of the video. Also, tomwoods.com/2489. Since you are coming to us from Australia, and since we're recording this late morning where I am, I feel bad that it's pretty late where you are, but I appreciate how cooperative and friendly you were about all this, and I hope people check out your work.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.